All right. Thank you so much for joining us. It's really exciting to be here with Bernie. As some of you may know, Bernie is one of the founders of the D School. He was a pioneer in robotics and kinematics, and he has this sort of interesting double life as a professor in that he has this, you know, incredibly advanced mathematical mind, and he writes incredibly sophisticated books for people who understand this rare form of mathematics and engineering. But he also, for many years, has been helping students to learn how to kind of be the best versions of themselves. And that's really what we're going to talk about tonight, this amazing book that he's just written, The Achievement Habit. So please, once again, can we have a round of applause for Bernie Roth? So you are now the author of a book called The Achievement Habit. So I am going to put you on the spot right from the beginning and ask you, what is your greatest achievement?
I'd say, and that's sort of what the word I should tell you right now, in all honesty, I use the word achievement in a different way than most people think of it. I have a friend who says, I'd never buy a book that says achievement in the title. But it's okay. I use it in terms of having a good life, in terms of not suffering through your life, flowing through your life, and being someone that you want to be with, being someone your family wants to be with, being someone the people you work with want to be with. So to me, the biggest achievement is living a good life. It's not piling up a lot of titles and money and stuff like that. So that's what I mean by achievement.
And you're somebody who has won a lot of important awards in your academic field. What does that part of your work mean to you?
Well, it's when you get it, it's nice. You know, most of these things are sort of hollow. I mean, they're great to get it, and sometimes you have a great dinner or something like that, and the next morning you wake up and you go on with your life. So I actually have them all in some big cabinet locked in my office, and I never look at them and fondle them or anything like that. But you know, they're nice, and I put a good part of my life into that, and it's nice that people recognize. There's nothing wrong with recognition, but it's not a thing that drives you. You know, some people's whole life is to get a Nobel Prize and all of that, and, you know, it's a wonderful thing, but I don't see the world as being driven that way. I think you get distorted in that.
So your definition of achievement strikes me kind of in this moment in Silicon Valley as a little bit unusual. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. Well, you know, a different trend. I'm actually reading Elon Musk's biography, he's complicated that way. So, you know, people have different things. And in different times of your life, you have different things. So I'm not a young guy anymore. So I have values I didn't have when I was younger. When I was younger, I would say I was more driven in the Silicon Valley mode, but I think not as strong as most. I was fortunate to grow up in a very socially minded neighborhood. We were an integrated neighborhood in the Bronx, New York, before people had words like integration or things like, just the whole idea was you're supposed to be nice to everybody and we're all in this world together. And one of the famous songs was Black and White Together and stuff like that. So I was brainwashed from an early age to look at those kind of things as being the important things. And we looked down at the capitalists and stuff like that. So a lot of my friends think I betrayed them by coming to Silicon Valley. You know?
Interesting. So when you work with students today and you start to express your ideas about achievement, what are the values that they seem to come to the table with, or the beliefs about achievement and success that you're noticing?
Yeah, well, I think it's a matter of people finding something that satisfies them and doing well in it in the way of getting up in the morning. And, you know, I usually am excited to get up in the morning and go to work, go to D school nowadays. I feel very lucky. I remember years ago, I was standing in front of the black, and I'd had some distress at home, and I picked up the chalk in those days, and I started to write, and I really didn't want to be there. And at that moment, I realized in my whole life, I've been teaching since 1962, there maybe been 3 days when I didn't want to be there. And that's a real gift.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So one of the things that really stands out to me when I read your book is that you do not like the word excuses. And can you talk a little bit about why that is?
Which word?
Excuses.
Excuses.
I know, it's
sure,
such a dirty
yeah.
word.
Yeah,
you don't even hear it when
yeah,
I say
yeah.
it.
Well, to me, excuses are essentially ways to not say what is. It's kind of letting yourself off the hook. And I think basically you do what you do in this world, and you have to take responsibility for it. And an excuse is a way of letting yourself not realize what you did. So if I'm late to something, oh, the traffic, you know, I was almost late here today, the traffic and all that. Well, you know, I know there's traffic between Palo Alto and here, so I should take the responsibility to leave early enough that even with the traffic I'd get here. But in everything, it's just a way of you letting off. And the thing with me is people, I have this word reasons. I actually have a sticker saying reasons are BS. And I have a very proper secretary. When she saw the sticker, she said, "Oh, that terrible word." And I said, "Yes, reasons." And and that's the way I feel. Reasons are a terrible word. You know, BS is okay. It's a good word. And reasons are excuses, really. And we just don't call them excuses because people think excuses are pejorative. When reasons are okay, you know, the reason I did that is so-and-so. And my feeling is you don't really know why you did anything. And there's a lot of behaviors. An example, right now my mouth is dry, okay? So it's because I'm talking a lot, right? That's a good reason, right? But the truth is, I don't tell you that last night we drank a bottle of champagne, we ate herring. I'm always dehydrated. My wife is always saying you don't drink enough water. I may be nervous. There's like 100 things that can contribute to the state. All I know is my mouth is dry at the moment. And once I give myself the reason, I let myself off the hook of all the other possibilities. So my feeling is it's really best in life not to use reasons. But you have to use them because people expect you to be a reasonable person. So if someone asks me something, I don't say, no, I don't use reasons. I give them a reason, whatever they want to hear. But I say to myself, you know, that's bullshit. Oh, that's a lie. I say to myself, that's not really what it is. I don't really know, or I do know what it is, and I'm hiding it. But the thing is, when you single out one thing of all the many things that cause your behavior, you are distorting it to make yourself look good or bad. If you think of yourself as a bad person, you're going to make it look bad. If you think of yourself as a good person, you're going to make yourself look good. So the real, and that's fine. There's no problem with it. The problem is if you ever want to change. So if you're always late and you always give yourself an excuse for the traffic, you'll never change. And what you have to do is if you see your behavior, give whatever reason you want to the other person to be reasonable, but then say, hey, I don't want to ever do that again. And you'll do it again. But if you keep doing it enough times, you'll stop doing it. And you'll never do that if you don't give yourself, if you let yourself get off the hook with the reasons. It's a long answer for a short question.
Is there a moment that comes to mind in your life when you started to realize that reasons are BS?
Yeah. Well, it came along. The one big incident that happened was I used to be on the board of directors of a company in Berkeley. And invariably, the board meeting would take place near the Berkeley campus. And I would leave from Stanford. In those days, it was Highway 17. And I came late all the time. And there was traffic. And I'd come in and I'd say, I'm really sorry, but there was heavy traffic. And they were very nice. They said, oh, as long as nothing happened, Bernie, it's okay. But I got to realize, you know, it's really abusive of me because these people are waiting. They had lives also. They have other things to do. And I was really kind of messing things up by my behavior. And once I realized that, it was simple. It was clear I was leaving too late. I just wasn't leaving enough time. It's not rocket science. And in those days, there were no cell phones. There were telephones. So, of course, I'd make 3 more phones before I left the office, 3 more phone calls, and do an email on my teletype in those days, and then meet someone at the elevator, a colleague, as I'm leaving, and schmooze for a little while. And, of course, now I left. It would be perfect if there was no traffic leaving Palo Alto and there's no traffic going into Berkeley and no traffic on Highway 17. That hardly ever happened. So I had it. I had the epiphany. I stopped doing that. And I left early. I left enough time. And I realized I just was not giving it enough valence in my life. In a way, I was looking down at that activity. And I said, am I going to do this activity or not? If I have the intention of doing it, of being on the board, then I should give it the attention it requires. And the attention is to leave early enough so no matter what, I'll be there on time. And it just changed my life. I lost all the anxiety and driving, the near-death experiences cutting in and out. You know, all that drama. You all have that drama, I'm sure, in your life. I got rid of that, and it was a pleasure. And sometimes I get there early, and I could oogle the co-eds at Berkeley or whatever it was. You know, whatever I did. But and sometimes I just get there and schmooze with the board people, which were delightful things also. So it was really a great experience. And I realized there were a lot of things in my life that way, and I just started working on changing it. And that's the story.
So when did you start to share these ideas with other people?
Well, I have this class called Designer in Society, which is, it's not a good name. That's a class. And I've been teaching a variant of that since 1970. And I teach it at least once a year if I'm not on sabbatical. So that kind of material is what comes in the class. So once I have the epiphany, it becomes in the class, and then I do creativity workshops and all that. So it's become a part of my being, and when I sat down to write this book, it just poured out of me. So it's I just remember that one incident with the board meetings, but it's just, once it came, it just became part of my being. It became my achievement habit, of all things.
So take me back to the beginnings of that class. Okay. As what was prompting you to integrate that material into the class at the time?
Yeah, well, it was interesting. When I came to Stanford in 1962, which is a long time ago, and it was a very different place, and the Valley was a very different place. And in those days, I was an engineering professor, and most people I dealt with, they were going to someday start their own company. First of all, there was no venture money to speak of. It was hard to start a company, but they all had this dream because there were these heroes, Hewlett and Packard, and you know the garage story and all that. But most of my students ended up working at Hewlett and Packard. They were the big employer, and some went to IBM down in San Jose. And I would meet them, and they would all say, you know, I'm going to start a company. And it reminded me of The Iceman Cometh, where they're all in the bar, and they just, every day, they're going to leave the bar, but they don't leave the bar for the entire play. So it was, you know, I have to do something. It's my responsibility not just to give people knowledge. It's my responsibility to give them the life they really want to have. So I made this class up, and one of the points was I'm going to have a term project. And the term project can be anything. It doesn't have to do with any subject. It has to do with you and your life. And one is do something you've always wanted to do in your life and never done, or get rid of a problem in your life. And as long as it met one of those two criteria, I was happy. And it was your project. You do it. And at the end, you'll tell us about it. And so what I tried to do with that is empower people to take responsibility for their lives, to take responsibility for doing stuff now, because students always think, after I graduate, I'm going to do it. But it doesn't work that way. It gets worse after you graduate because you have a family, you have more responsibility and all that. So you have to realize now is when you have to do stuff. So it turned out it was kind of magic, because when people started doing it and they had the success, they went on and did it. I had this one woman, she had never learned how to swim. Her mother was afraid of water. She'd never learned how to swim. So her project was to learn how to swim. You know, big deal in a way. But then she graduated, and then she went and she learned Italian. And then she decided she didn't like her profession. So she took courses and changed her job. And every time she gave me credit for it. Now, I think she deserves the credit. But what happened is she flipped. She flipped from someone who took what she had and just, you know, she could have learned to swim long before my class. She didn't need me. I didn't give her swimming lessons. And I didn't give her Italian lessons. So it's that kind of a thing. And then the people who got rid of a problem in their lives, you know, a lot of these stories make you cry. They're just so, so much moving things. And just think about, this one fellow, his problem was he was not reconciled with his father. And he decided to reconcile with his father, and that was his project. And he worked, and it worked out okay. And then 2 months later, his father died. He had an aneurysm and died. So, it's quite moving.
Hmm. Was that one of the earliest moments when you really knew that you were onto something with this class?
Yeah, it happened quite quickly. You know, it was funny because I was a young professor, and my chairman, he was a typical engineer. You know, he saw the world the way engineers did in those days. And he called me in when I started, and he said, Roth, you don't get this. He says, engineering has to do with things, not with people. So cut out this people stuff and go back to machine design, which is what you know stuff about. And, you know, he doesn't have that view anymore now at all. In fact, he had an 80th birthday party some years back, and I was called. I wondered why they invited me, because I wasn't close to him at all. But they invited me to recite that story. And he said, you son of a bitch, you remember. but at any rate, it was kind of risky in a way, but people were worried about people breaking windows, and, you know, it was the Vietnam moment. So I had a little space. And by the time things got back to normal, it was the highest rated class in the department. So they weren't going to get rid of that. So it was just being at the right place at the right time, having a sensitivity to something and acting on it. And I'm thrilled. We wouldn't be here tonight if I hadn't done that. And there's been a lot of beauty in my life and my connections coming from it. So at the time, people said, you're crazy to do that. But I didn't really feel it was a great risk. But, you know, it probably was not the smartest thing, but it was the smartest thing.
So you have been teaching at Stanford for almost 53 years, and more recently, you've now started hanging out at the D School. I see you every day there. So can you talk a little bit about what that has meant in terms of that shift in your focus?
Sure, yeah. Well, it's kind of interesting. It's changed my life, and I was happy in my old life. I mean, I had a really good life. I was in the top of my field. I had great students. No one bothered me. I could teach what I wanted. I liked my research. I was not unhappy at all. And then Dave Kelly, who was a student of ours and who I was a colleague and I had helped him get promoted, he sort of said, look, we want to do this new thing, and I don't know anything about the university. I'm a businessman. You know everything about the university, so why don't you join our discussion group? So I joined the discussion group, and we talked about something changing our design program, and then at some point, a lot of money walked in the door, and suddenly we had what's called a D School. And it was okay, and I was teaching a little bit, but I still had my other life. And then David got cancer. He had a serious cancer experience, and he had to have chemotherapy and radiation, so he stepped out of the picture. And I was minding my own business, and then late one Friday night, the dean called me. He said, look, I'm very nervous. I'm going on a trip. I want to have a faculty person in charge. David's not there. I want a faculty. Would you mind doing it? So I thought, like, one microsecond. I didn't negotiate. I said, sure, I'll do it. And that was Friday. Monday morning, I walked in, and I never left. And I just gave up my old life, and it was just a different thing. It was very engaging. It was new also. It was very exciting, and it took off like gangbusters. But it was just it changed every way I worked. So, for example, in my old life, I had a private office. And a professor's private office is sacred. People will kill you for their private office. And what it is, it's a room, you shut your door, you have all your papers and your books and all that, and then your students come in, they sit on the other side of the desk, and you're in the power position, and, you know, all that. People come to your shrine. And what I realize now, it's so isolating. And when people come in, you're in a way resentful because they're disturbing you. And when you go into someone else's private office, you don't know how long to stay. When should I get out and stuff like that. So there's this whole funny dynamic that I never noticed. I was always very happy with it. In the D School, there are no private offices. We're in this big bullpen. We're together. I'm, say, the person with the highest stature there. And right next to me, I've been there the longest. I'm the oldest. I'm the most accomplished. I have the biggest title. And right next to me is someone we just hired 3 days ago who was just out of undergraduate school, who... It's just, you know, a normal, nice person. And we just mix. There's no hierarchy in it. And it changes where we are. And when I come in there every morning, it's like coming home to my second home. It's like I'm not isolated in this room and locked off. I'm in with a lot of people. So it's great for communication. You know what's going on. You know, it's a lot's going on at the school. We have a meeting every Monday morning where we put up what's going on for the week. And then I find 40 things I never heard about going on that week. So there's a lot going on, and just to be there and be part of it is really great, and it forms very close relationships. There's a lot of hugging and kissing. We had a, Sarah was there, we had an event in the School of Engineering where they give awards to people who employees 5 years, 10 years, you get like a pin or something like that, and every department had their people there, and they come up and the professor shakes the person's hand, and at D school, every employee, I'm hugging them, Sarah's hugging them, we're kissing, and the dean said, this is a very hugging group we have in the D school. But that's the way you feel. You don't feel like they're more than work people, and they are work people, but it's a kind of close thing, and I never realized that. And I'm close to my other people in engineering also, but not the same way. So, yeah, it's a change, and it feels great. Mm.
And you've told me before about the change it's given you in terms of the relationship that you cultivate with students, right? The power position is different.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. So that's another interesting insight. So what I realized, I'm pretty good teacher. I give pretty good lectures, and I give lectures to crowds like this, and bigger crowds, and smaller crowds, and I can stand up in the podium and crack jokes and all that stuff, and I get very high ratings. But what I realized in a way, it's a kind of power trip, and that the message to the student is, wait a minute, you can't do anything. You can't be like Bernie Roth. And of course they couldn't. I've been studying robotics for 40 years, wrote the books, did the research. How could someone just walk in and be anywhere like me? So they could admire me. And they could think, okay, if I pay my dues and I study and I work, eventually I might be like this guy. If they want, maybe they don't want to be like me at all. But, I could do that. In the D school, the situation is totally different. What it is, if we take a project on, I don't know anything about the project any more than the students do. I know the process. I'm an expert on the process. I know how to guide people. I know how to facilitate. But once they start to work on the process, on the project, within 3 days, they know a lot more about it than I do. That is very empowering. That is very empowering because they don't have to wait to graduate to do something. And they do. And it's amazing what these people do. And it's just this whole thing of, it's a different slanted education. They're both okay. I mean, they both have different purposes. But I never realized before, kind of in a way, and I think I'm a very approachable professor and all that, but still in all, I think I was kind of giving a wrong message in my old life.
It's very powerful. I think a lot of your work is about breaking down those hierarchies and getting people to realize that they can do more for themselves than they may realize. Why is that such an important part of you?
I sort of believe, we run the D School pretty much as a flat organization, and I had a lot to say in my design group in mechanical engineering, and that was the flat, the dean used to call it the people's democracy. I mean, that was it was the only flat organization in the whole engineering school, and we never had a director, and every other group had a director. So I believe very much on flat organizations because they empower people. So we have we hire two young professors. One started last year and the other's going to start in September. They already go to the meetings that only the big boys go to in the other groups. In other words, immediately they have equal rights for everything. We never vote on anything. We just kind of discuss, we decide, and we have a whole procedure. But I find that it resonates with my personality. It really resonates with my personality. And reading, I think it's like ridiculous, because if you read Engels, he thinks every ship needs to have a captain. And if you read Adam Smith, he thinks every ship needs to have a captain. So here's the prominent figures in capitalism, communism, they all think it has to be hierarchical. And here's this little professor who doesn't believe in that stuff. But I must say it resonates with my personality, and I really think it works. I mean, this thing that we've had before the D school is an incredibly successful operation without. So it's, I know I'm a singular voice that way, but it talks to me, that kind of stuff, and it suits me. And I've been lucky enough to be able to have my entire working life be that way.
So, I mean, you've been using the tools of design thinking even before it was really called design thinking in your class. And often design thinking is thought about in a context of innovation, right? Working to develop a new product or service.
Yeah.
But in your book, you're really talking about a much more personal application. So yeah. do the tools change? Is it different somehow?
Yeah. Well, you know, where that started, it's funny. I used to give talks on designing stuff and, you know, the robots and things like that. And I'd always have this line in there, even the very beginning, life is like design. I mean, you get a problem. So in design, your boss or someone, your customer gives you a problem, and there are obstacles, and you have to keep it out. In your life, depending on who you believe in, nature or nurture or anything, you get a problem, you're born, and you get all sorts of obstacles. So I always saw the analogy there. It always felt very strong to me, and I remember giving a lot of talks that way. And then I started doing these creativity workshops, and I had this friend, Rolf Fasti, who unfortunately died, who one of the people the book is dedicated to. And we used to do these workshops for companies. So General Motors wanted us to do a workshop on creativity and car door design. So we would always say, all right, to get in the door. But we would say the title is Creativity and Car Door Design and Life. And we always had the and life stuck on whatever it was. And when we got there, we mainly did life. We didn't do the car door. So they didn't often invite us back, but we got our licks in. but I always felt that, and I saw the parallel. I mean, it just seemed so obvious to me, and that it was the same, and it's more important. You know, most people, if you're naive, you think people learn about life or from their religion or their parents and all that. Well, most people don't. I never discussed life with my parents. I never discussed any of those things with my parents. They were poor working class people. They were just trying to get ahead, you know. Most of us didn't. So where do you get it? Well, if you're going to university, you ought to get it there if no one else gives it to you. And I felt that's part of my job. And I never, my PhD students, I didn't force anyone to. One of my PhD students came up from Paso Robles, on way to San Francisco. Yes, he stopped off for lunch, and he has the book now. He says, you know, I'm really sorry I never took those courses. He took the hard courses, you know. He never took that. He says, I'm really sorry I never took that course. I really think I missed out. And I told him, look, you know, I never felt it was my job to kind of push my graduate students into taking the course. If it appealed to someone, they can, and that's it. And it was like just two different lives. But I feel this part, the people part, was really the best thing I did, even though on a social thing and the thing I'm most confident to probably academically is the other stuff. But anyone can do the other stuff. And this stuff is so rarely done and it's so important. And I cannot tell you, I've sent emails to ex-students about the book. I cannot tell you the emails I got back. I showed some to Sarah. I mean, I've been crying for like a week. It's just amazing. It's just so warm. And this was the most important thing I did. I cannot tell you how many times people have told me, this class is the most important class I've ever taken at Stanford. And there are people, you know, in very high positions with other kinds of accomplishments who'll tell me that. And it's empowering. And the truth is, most of the stuff you learn in school, you don't really need. You don't really apply it in your life. When I went to the City College of New York, which was a tough school, they flunked, not like Stanford, they flunked out a lot of people at City College. It was easier to get in, but it was hard to stay in. And at Stanford, the idea is if they admit you, you deserve to graduate. At City College, just because they admit you doesn't mean you deserve to graduate. And what I would say the best thing I learned at City College was to sit on my behind until I got the job done, to stay up all night and do a problem set, to just deliver, because there was all these requirements I had to deliver. That's what I'd say I learned from City. All the other stuff I don't use. I learned about steam engines. There are not many steam engines around now, you know, stuff, you know. So it's kind of really interesting. What stayed with me were the habits of work and the, you know, some basic things, reading, writing, and arithmetic. But beyond that, everything I've used since then, I've learned myself out of school. And I think that's true with many people. We've done surveys of grads and all that. And the thing that people learn is not so much their major and the knowledge. And there's some people it's important. But for most people, it's just this behavior, the way to deal in the world, these kind of meta things that we don't teach them and they don't deal with. And so I feel really great about that.
So one of those core design principles that you talk a lot about is reframing, which really resonates with me. So can you talk a little bit about how that plays a role in cultivating this habit of achievement?
Sure. Well, you know, reframing is funny. It's been around for a long time. Anyone who's gone to a psychiatrist or a therapist, I'm sure they've told you to reframe a problem and stuff. So it's not that it's there. It's not magic, but it's kind of, we used to call it need finding and stuff like that. And the idea is to make sure you're working on the right problem. And I find that if you want to have one single cause for people getting stuck and not solving problems, smart people like everyone in the audience and like myself and my colleagues and Sarah, it's because we're working on the wrong problem. And if you reframe a problem, it's like magic. It often just solves itself. But even if it doesn't, most people mistake a solution for a problem. So they have something which is really a solution, and they can't implement it because it's the wrong thing. And even if they implement it, it wouldn't give them what they want. So reframing is a very important tool. And when it happens, it's magic. It's just magic. And, you know, there have been some wonderful stories in the D-School.
So how does it work?
Well, it works in that... It works like everything, all different ways. And, you know, you can wake up in the middle of the night and get an epiphany. But in the formal way we talk about it, it works in that you go out and do what's called empathy work. You actually talk to people. So one of the tenets of design thinking is you must talk to the people you design for. That seems like a no-brainer. But in fact, it's not true. Most people talk to experts. They don't talk to the people it's for. So one of the big things is to not talk to the other experts and the professionals and the people who know everything, but talk to the people who the thing ultimately is going to be for. And if you do that, you can, and it's hard. It's like being an anthropologist. You have to have your eyes open. The right thing has to happen in front of you and all that. But if it does, you realize, wow, this is a magic moment. One is a cute one, sort of a trivial thing. We were doing a project on pregnancy, and the team was in some house talking to some pregnant woman. There were another house talking to pregnant woman. And one house, the husband was letting them out the door as they were leaving. And he says, you know, everyone always worries about the woman. No one worries about the husband. And that was it. Like, let's do a project for husbands in pregnancy. No one ever looks at it. And it was a great project. It was an example that it was just some word in passing, and it reframed the whole problem because they were all focused on the women. Well, everyone's focused on pregnant women. You're not going to get too far with that one. So, and there are some other ones that are just amazingly happened. You know, shall I go on with another one?
Please, yeah.
Okay. So the one you were familiar with, you were coaching the team, I think, is this one. It's called. It has to do with the premature children. It's gotten a lot of publicity. I'm sure most of you have heard about it. But basically, the problem came in from in Nepal from some medical people, and they have incubators there for premature children, which are equivalent to what we have in America. They cost around $20,000, and the issue was they need electricity. And in Nepal, the electricity is intermittent. So one of them is, what do you do about that? The other thing is they tend to break. They're complicated machines, and they really weren't able to fix them. So how can we make it so we can fix it? So when the students started to work on the problem, they started to redesign to make less parts, so it wouldn't break as much and be fixable. And they started to think in terms of battery backups. That's a no-brainer. You have battery backups, and it'll work. And then eventually they get to go to Nepal and to actually look at the scene and do the empathy work. Up until now, they've just been talking to the experts, to the doctors and all that. They get to Nepal, they see, even if these things work, they're in the villages. They're not where the mothers are. The mothers are up in the hills. There's no way a mother can come with a premature child and keep it alive long enough to get there. Or the mother can't leave the other children at home and go, so she'll let the child die. So they realized the issue was not keep the incubators working. The issue is, how do you keep the babies warm? And the customer that they were working for is the babies and the pregnant mother. And in this case, they happened to hit upon a design which seems simple but is more complicated than it seems. It looks like a little sleeping bag. So you put the child in a little sleeping bag, and then they found a wax-like substance which you can heat with electricity if you have it, but you can boil it in water, you can heat it any way you want, and it melts. And once it melts, you put it in the bag, and it keeps the right temperature for 4.5 hours. And that was great. And they did it by experimenting with margarine. They bought margarine in the Safeway, and they figured this whole thing out. And they were kind of nervous because the easy solution was to do the battery backups and all that. And Sarah was the coach, and she said, go for it. Take a chance. Take a risk. And it's amazing. I don't know what the number is. It's like 70,000, 80,000 babies have been saved now, and every day it's growing and all that. So it's an example of reframing. The problem was a problem. Keep the incubators working. And the real problem is keep the babies warm. And that happens over and over and over again. If you have the right problem, it's magic. And if you have the wrong problem, it's a kludgy answer, if an answer at all.
And that speaks also to those students were empowered to look at the problem differently.
Yes.
Right.
Which,
yes. So in just a few minutes, we're going to ask you who have questions to come up. There's going to be a microphone in this middle aisle. So start thinking about some of the questions that you might have for Bernie. I'm going to ask you a few more while we have some time. One of the really interesting things about the book is the actual design of the book, and that it's not just a memoir, it's not just a set of exercises, it's all these things together. And I know you collaborated really closely with the illustrator of the book. Can you talk a little bit about that process?
Sure. Well, the illustrator deserves a lot. He's actually a young man who works with us. Thomas Both is his name. And it was kind of interesting in that I had someone else, and they got very busy, and they couldn't do it. And I just wanted to have pictures in front of every chapter. And we came up with a cover, and the publisher didn't like it at all. It's too childish. It's too childlike. A book will never... This is a serious business book. It'll never sell. And what had happened throughout the whole process of editing, the publisher had been bothering me, what's the design thinking point of this? What's the design thinking point of that? It's like a little obnoxious, but I try to accommodate them. But then I finally could turn it around. We had these illustrations. They looked at them. They rejected them as being childlike. I said, but in design thinking, we use illustrations like that. So they surrendered. So I love them. And you look at the book, you'll see. It has that flavor, which is kind of sketchy. It's not, professional drawing. But it has a clever idea behind it. It has a statement behind it. And I couldn't be more pleased than it came out. And it was just a pleasure working. It was just this is a family. It was like it was in the family, It was an emergency. This guy, he was sick. It was just an amazing experience. Mm. Yeah.
Was there any part of the book that was more difficult than the others to write for you?
Well, I wrote a chapter about a lot of friends who died, and that was sort of difficult.
Yeah. Mm. What prompted you to include so many personal stories?
Well, that's the way I teach, actually. I teach my class with my personal stories and their personal stories. So let's say we have a thing and I talk about projection. So then I'll say, okay, your assignment for today is go out and see how you and your friends use projection. And then they come back the next week and we give war stories. And I tell about how I use projection in my family, in my life. And we kind of make it not abstract, but really concrete. And I feel that's really important that even if you think these theories are great, if they don't apply in your life, who cares in a way? It's just an aesthetic pleasure. But I'm very pragmatic and I very much do that. So that's the way I teach. I teach with my stories. I tell my life stories. Every year it's different. I have more stories. Some I tell every year. They're so good. But every year, whatever happens, I did this, and I had a fight with my wife, and I did this, and I did that, and my son did that, and these jerks I bike with did that, and and I tell that. And then they tell their stories, and it opens you up. And it's ironic, because people think if you open yourself up, people aren't going to like you. People are going to see you're not perfect personally. And it's just the opposite. The students that open themselves up the most get the most love from everyone, the most friendship. It's really ironic. If you're willing to expose yourself, everyone has the same issues. I do a thing where you talk about the last time something happened in your life. Everyone has any issue you can think of. We're all human. We have similar issues. And if I think Bernie has this weird issue and all that, I'm kind of hiding back. You shouldn't see that. But if we all know that, Bernie argues with his wife. Can you believe that? I don't think she's going to divorce me after 62 years, but I don't know. We'll see.
Well, on that note, let's take some questions from the audience. Okay. Please go ahead.
Sarah and Bernie, thank you for coming tonight. How do you know when you're design thinking your life right?
When you, what, say again, how do you know?
How do you know when you're design thinking your life correctly? How do you know when you're doing it right?
How do you know when you're doing it right?
Oh, in design thinking? It's like any, well, I'm very pragmatic. I use my belly, you know, if it works right, you feel it. But there's no right and wrong. There's absolutely no right and wrong. It's just a matter of if you find something marvelous, it's going to speak to you. And if you find something where you're kludging and you're dressing, you know, you're dragging along, you know that also. So it's just a matter of being truthful to yourself. And sometimes time is up and there are no more resources and you have to give something that you're not very proud of. But sometimes there's enough time to keep looking and all that and you get this big aha. So there's no equations for it or anything like that in the kinds of stuff we do. And usually it's the people you're working with. So if they accept it, it's a really interesting story with the rest of the story with the embrace, with this incubator story, is they got the sleeping bag, they did the whole thing, they were very proud of it, they went to India, and the parents hated it. The mothers hated it. And it turns out that it looked like a shroud. It looked like the child was already dead. So what they did is they figured out, they put a window in it right here. So the mother could see, you know, they could see it, you know, it's covered with plastic, but you could see through it and all that. And that changed the game. So that's an example where they sort of had a solution, but it wasn't accepted by the person it was for, by the people it was for. And once they did it, everyone wants it. And if everyone wants it, you're probably on a good track, you know?
Hi, I'd like to apply design thinking to my life. I was wondering, aside from buying the book, yes, what is one step, one thing I can do either tonight before I go to bed or one thing tomorrow when I wake up that I can do to help implement that?
Sure. Well, I could say just be mindful of yourself and your life, and if something doesn't seem that it's working for you, look at it honestly, don't sweep it under the rug. And just say, I'd like to change it. What can I do to change it? And that's a simple way to begin. You could also go to our website and all that stuff, but basically it's got to be you. You can memorize all this stuff and go nowhere with it. You have to be honest with yourself. You have to be open. You have to be mindful of what's going on in your life and the world around you. And then it'll take care of itself.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, thank you for this talk. I have a question about, I wrote it down because I won't be able to remember it. We live in a city where everyone, or at least a lot of the people we meet, are impressive with numbers of advanced degrees and achievements in a certain sense. So what's your advice to someone who feels behind or gets stuck comparing themselves to someone else?
I didn't get that, was it?
So what's your advice for someone who feels like they're comparing their success to someone else?
Dave, what?
Comparing their own success to someone else.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, if that's what you want to do, you're going to do that. I would say, you know, most people are worried about themselves. They're not worried about anyone else. So you're not worried about my hairdo, and I'm not worried about your hairdo. And, you know, or whatever you're worried about coming here, that was your worry and I have my worry. So all that stuff is you made up. You know, you give the whole world its meaning. You give everything in your life its meaning. So if you want to compare yourself to someone else, do it. If you don't, stop. It's as simple as that. I just got a letter today. I got a letter for today from a woman who used to be president of a college. And she told me she had some problems early in her life because in those days it was hard for a woman to get an academic job. She was married to an academic, and she was the faculty wife in those days. And her epiphany came. She realized at some point that you choose everything in your life, either by doing it or by not doing it. And it's as simple as that. So who's choosing to compare you with everyone else? The other person's not choosing. You're choosing it. So if you want to stop, stop. It's as simple as that. Now you have to have what I call the intention and the attention. So you have to give it you have to have the intention to really stop, not a pipe dream that I'd like it to stop. But I really would like to stop this behavior. It's not functional for me. And what will it take to do it? Most of the time it just takes to stop doing it. We have time for I'll give you my example. I was going around the world teaching this kind of stuff, and I was about retirement age, a long time ago. And I was in Sweden. I remember the moment. It was KTH is like the MIT of Sweden, and I was waxing eloquently and teaching people how to solve their own problems. And at night, I was losing sleep trying to decide whether I should retire or not. In the middle of this workshop, I said, you know, I ought to apply this stuff to myself if it works. So I went home that night and I applied my method. And I realized the only reason, the only thing the problem was, should I retire or not? And where'd that problem come from? I really didn't care. I thought society wanted me to make that decision. Society wasn't worried about Bernie Roth. Society was doing whatever society does. So at that moment, I said, well, I could just stop worrying about it. And I did. And and I've never once thought about retiring or not retiring. And it was so example. Here I'm the guru and all that. And I was beating myself up with something because society had brainwashed me to thinking when you came to that age, you had to worry about it. The law had changed. I didn't have to do anything. It was no problem. And it's the same thing with you. Who's making you compare yourself to others? It's not me. It's not Sarah, right? So it's got to be only one person, probably the person at the microphone. Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We feel very lucky he has not retired yet.
Hi.
Please speak right into the mic.
Hi. I just wanted to know what you thought about a lot of startups have adopted the term design thinking to mean paper prototyping and kind of taking a bunch of post-its and moving them around and grouping them to make an app. And I just wanted to know what your process was with regard to that and what you thought about that, because it's that to me, to a lot of people who, you know, don't know the origins of design thinking, is what design thinking is.
So what does she do? The app? What does she
Can you say that last part again?
Yeah, I don't know which is the last part, but what I was
say it simply. So embellish it. Just say what is the thing you want to know.
Okay, what I want to know is what do you think about the fact that a lot of tech startups have adopted the term design thinking to mean working with paper prototypes and post-it notes.
Sure. Okay. Yeah,
I wasn't trying to be.
That's fine. I got it. So I have no opinion about it. If they want to do it, that's fine. I hope it works for them. But design thinking, like everything, has some tools and stuff like that. To me, the most important thing about design thinking are mindsets. So actually, I wrote this book by invoking a design thinking mindset called bias towards action, okay? So these are useful ways of framing your life. Whether you use post-its or not, it doesn't matter. So design thinking is a fashionable word now, and if it works for your company and the troops rally around it, that's great. We get a lot of benefit from people liking it, so I do it any way you want. But I'd say these things are useful, and in certain problems they really can help a lot. It's good to have post-its because you can group things and regroup them. And, you know, they have a reason they're there, but you don't need them. You don't need them at all. The main thing is the mindsets that go with it, like not having a fear of failure. But literally that. I mean, everyone says it, but literally not being afraid to fail, and if you fail, to learn from it, is a very important part of what I call design thinking. And it differentiates from the more analytical kind of thinking, which I used to do in my other part of my life. So it's just a different way of looking at things and different kind of permissiveness. I got another note. I get all these notes from these students. This guy was a student in the 70s, and he was a Chicano, first generation in his family, and he came to Stanford. He was totally terrorized, and he was in a house called Zapata House, which they set up for just sort of Chicano thing, and I was the advisor. And he says, Bernie, he just sent me this email like 2 days ago. I haven't seen him yet. He said, you know, you saved me, and then my daughter came to Stanford and all that, and I'll never forget what you told me. And I'm waiting. What did I tell him? I'm looking at the next slide. And it was, take it easy, it'll be all right. I take credit for it, you know, it's profound. But that's what it is, you know. People worry it too much, and the name, it's a kind of, there are all sorts of tools in the world, and it's great. One of my happiest moments, we used to do this workshop for PhD students for a week before school started, and I remember, like, a month later, I was biking on the campus. This woman stops me. She had taken the week-long workshop on design thinking. She grabs me, she starts hugging me and kisses, Bernie, I love you. I said, what's going on? She says, and it's in my genetics lab, I used design thinking for this experiment, and it took 1/10 the time, and it worked perfectly, and everyone thinks I'm a genius. I love you. So basically, we added something to her tool base. And that, to me, is what our business at the D School is about with the students, to add it to their tool base and whoever they are and whatever they want to do, that's fine. And we use design thinking as just a thing that people don't know much about outside of us. So we're doing that. But eventually, it maybe we'll go on to something else. Our main thing is to create people who will be, have, dare I say it, have the achievement habit in my definition of that term. Yeah. Thank you.
Let's go ahead.
Wow, the line goes so fast. Actually, I don't have any question when I was standing on the line, but you said, take it easy, you'll be all right. And then I decided to be here. And then the question just come out from my mind. So you mentioned the reframing problems, and it reminds me of the saying from Alan Kay, who says that the stupidest way to solve a problem is to directly solve the problem, and the smartest way is that to change the problem, and then it would be much easier. And so this thing is actually my intention here to come in tonight. Well, what really want to know, like, well, how to soak that way of thinking, that reframing, that in reframing problem into every part of every day, every detail of your life.
Yes.
Because if you really think about that, you would definitely get lost and you just be thinking you are not at the moment, you can't solve things.
Well, there are techniques and they're demonstrable to you and they're written up and you know, it's there are ways of helping you do that once you realize that you're stuck. So my advice is, if you're solving a problem and it's going very well, don't worry about anything. Just solve it and take the solution and be happy. You know, that's, don't look for trouble. But if, in fact, you're stuck in all that, then you need some methods to help you get unstuck. And that's kind of our business. So that's, so, and I cannot tell you this minute what they are, but there's a book, there's websites. We have a very nice website in the D School that gives you a lot of that. And, you know, we do workshops and stuff like that. But you can have that experience. And maybe we'll be able to give you a little bit of that experience after the session is over.
Yeah, thank you.
Hi. You speak a lot about habits and thinking. And to me, those are very much activities that are focused on the self. And when I think about other types of habits, like trying to go to the gym, it's often helpful to have, for example, a gym buddy, external types of factors.
Yes. Yeah.
Can you speak about some of the external factors that you would look for to help somebody with design thinking?
Sure, sure. Well, you know, there's the whole field of behavioral modification, all that, and people have things called triggers that will get you to go to the gym and stuff like that. But my own feeling is, you know, those work for some people. They don't work for others. Statistically, they may work, but they don't work for it. To me, it's mainly you and your mindset. And I find that it's like a switch, you know. So you could spend your whole life dieting and still never get to where you want to get. Or you could have a switch. And the switch says when you go to a supermarket, don't buy the ice cream or whatever it is. But, you know, and there's this stuff of excuses and lying to yourself. So my whole thing is very personal-centered, and just like teaching, I can't teach anything to anyone if they don't want to learn it. You know, it's as simple as that. So you have to know where you're at, and you have to stop lying to yourself, and you have to do that by not using reasons and excuses. Okay? So my world is very simple, and I have a whole difference between trying to do something and do something. So in my life, I noticed that people mix the two up. And, you know, there's this great thing from Star Wars, there's no try, just do. Everyone loves that. I don't think that's that great, although I understand the sentiment and I like it, because there is a try. Try is okay, but just don't think you're doing when you try. So to me, they're just two different states. So if you try and do something, you may or may not do it. If you try and go to the gym, you may get there, you may not get there. You know, someone may come up, something better may come. But if you're going to do the gym, no matter what happens, you're going to go. So I take a yoga class every Friday at noon, and I'm there every Friday at noon. Except when I'm not, but I'm mainly there every Well, I'm not a jerk about it. If I'm in France, I'm not there, you know, so I don't want to misrepresent it. But, you know, if I've chosen to go somewhere else, I made that decision. But it's not that I'm sitting home, should I go to the gym or not, should I go to yoga class or not. I mean, if I'm physically with insight. So it's that kind of a thing, and people kid themselves, and I find that's very empowering if you understand the difference between try and do. And people have taken my workshops, report all sorts of things at companies and all that. And once you understand that, it's a kind of like magic thing. So if you try, it may or may not happen, and it's fine if it does or it doesn't. If you're going to do it, just because there's an obstacle doesn't mean it's not going to happen. See, if you try and you get an obstacle, you stop. If you're going to do it, there's an obstacle, you walk around the obstacle, whatever it takes. Okay? And that's an important thing to understand. So to me, that's hooked in with this notion of intention and attention and trying and doing. So all these things come together when you talk about doing something like that. I don't know if that's what you want to hear.
No, that's perfect. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
All right, this is our last question.
All right, cool. So earlier you mentioned from one of your stories this idea of vulnerability and honesty and how your students that display vulnerability and are honest with their peers, they're the ones that kind of reap the most benefits and make kind of serious connections. And I feel that in my personal life, but in a professional context, I think there is a kind of a tension that exists, especially here in the Bay Area where we have to sell a version of ourselves inflated, right?
Okay.
And so how do you inject vulnerability and honesty in that?
Yeah, thank you. That's a very good question. All right. When I'm talking about honesty, I'm talking about honesty to yourself. So if you know you're choosing to sell yourself and to portray yourself in some exaggerated way, as far as I'm concerned, that's fine as long as you know you're doing it. But if you kid yourself and you think you're being honest and you're not doing it, that's to me the problem that you're someday going to run into trouble with. So I'm very pragmatic, you know what I mean? I'm not one of these extreme people that every word. But it's the thing is with yourself, not necessarily with, and I'm not saying to lie and cheat and steal, but I'm just saying whatever it takes to do, you do it. But, you know, I'm not going to kill you to do it, you know. So within the moral, ethical bounds that you have for yourself, which you have to decide for yourself, I have mine, you have yours. You have to be honest to yourself and do what you're going to do. So, and the problem is most time people delude themselves by saying, I'm doing it for your own good. So, you know, if I have an employee, I say, I'm firing you for your own good. You know, so I'm telling you this for your own good. I'm not so big on that. I think you do it for your own, not for their good, but for your own good. So I think it's really important to be honest with yourself and look deep down into yourself, and then choose what you're going to do. And if you do that, I think you'll have a pretty good life for whatever you want. How's that? You're smiling. Are you happy?
Yeah, no, that was good.
Good, all right.
Thank you.
So, Bernie, just a few more questions, then we'll close. So are there particular habits that you have? You just mentioned yoga, actually, once a week. But are there particular habits that you have on a daily basis that have led you to have your own achievement habit?
Well, I bicycle daily to work, and I bike every Sunday I'm there. I bike with my biking buddies on a big trip if I'm in the country. And I do that no matter what, only if it really rains very heavily. There are times when no one shows up and I'm there biking in the rain. So it's really an important part of my life. And I remember the first time I did it, I said, these guys are crazy. Who would do this to their body? I mean, I suffered so much. It was this big ride. It was up the hills. This guy's nuts. And then I did it another time, and then it became easy, and now it's part of my life. I really miss it if I'm traveling. I really miss it very much. So it became a habit. It's an example of that. And there are all sorts of things that are habits in my life. My wife says I eat ice cream. I'm addicted. It's a habit. So, but, you know, there are different things. And their habits are rituals with people, you know. So my son phones me. There's a kind of ritual. There's a ritual every morning. I ask my wife if she slept okay. Those are kind of habits. So, and, they're fine if you function. But if the thing is, if they don't function, if they're dysfunctional, you ought to change them. And we all have dysfunctional habits. And I've had a lot of them, and I'm slowly ridding myself of them. And I get more. You know, it's not. No one is perfect. No one will ever be perfect. And it's a lifelong job to do this stuff. And I think it's better if you're mindful and you do it. It's part of your life's work to just keep improving yourself. And as an educator, I'm improving students and I'm improving myself. I get as much out of that class every year I do it than I had done it. And we read books. I reread the same books every year. And I get every time I read it, I get something else out of it. So it's a kind of thing, you're never there. You know, it's not like an inoculation. All right, Bernie's going to give you the magic cure. Read this and you're done for life. It doesn't work that way. But if you're mindful, you can have a much better life. You don't have to be stuck with your problems. You can do the things you always wanted to do. You don't need this bucket list kind of stuff. Just do it, you know, just do it. And it's just, it's much more satisfying. And know the difference between pipe dreams and real things you want to do. And pipe dreams are great. I love them. But it's fine. If you do, you don't get it, it doesn't matter. It's just a pipe dream. But if you have something really you want to do, then you have to give it attention and intention to have it done.
Is there one student who comes to mind that you feel like you've really learned something from?
Well, I've learned something from many students. So I can't say any one outstanding thing. It's a continual thing, and it's always small things, sometimes a big thing. But I think I've just learned to be more honest and open. I'd say the one thing I've learned from many of them is they dared to expose themselves, so I did. In the beginning, I was very hesitant. You know, I was. You don't do this. You don't talk to students like that. You don't say those kind of things. You don't tell them that a professor did this. And as they expose, you know, when a guy tells me his mother's an alcoholic and all that, then I can tell him about my father's stuff and all that. You know, it's just kind of a give and take. And that's what I learned from them.
Yeah, so that reciprocity.
Yeah.
Yeah. So our final question, 60-second question. From your book or from your life, is there one 60-second idea that you have that would really change the world if it came true?
Well, I must say, I don't think in terms of changing the world. So, and in our field, people talk about scaling and all that. And my thing is, if I can help one person, I'm really happy. Some people say if you can't help less than 100,000 people, I mean, don't bother. I'm more humble than that, you know. And so I'd say the thing you can really do to change the world is if we were all kind of nice to ourselves and our families and friends and the people we work for, we're going to change the world if we all do it. And so it'll be viral. It's to be high-tech about it. So start a viral thing of making your life work and the people around you's life work, and the world will change. How's that?
I love it.
All right.
Thank you so much.